Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for the next hour of medical news, healthcare, science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussions, answers to your emails and calls here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. And we had some interesting emails this week. This one, a follow-up from something we did talk about, trigeminal neuralgia. This is from Michael in Monterey. I'm interested in the connection between trigeminal neuralgia and herpes that you just mentioned. I started having trigeminal neuralgia about a year ago. At that time, it got worse gradually and wasn't associated with anything in particular. It was fairly successfully treated with the generic Tegretol. By last July, I was off the nerve calmer. Then a little over a week ago, it started up again. My neurologist again put me on 100 milligrams twice a week of Tegretol, but I noticed this time I had a mild lip herpes outbreak at about the same time as the trigeminal neuralgia started up. I wondered whether this was a coincidence or an actual connection, and where would I find more about this possible link? Well, to answer your second question first, Michael, just about any neurology textbook or good discussion of trigeminal neuralgia will mention that. It's a known association. You have had two outbreaks now, so you might consider the use of prophylactic low-dose anti-herpes medication, something like a low-dose Zovirax daily. I don't know about your other medical issues and whether or not you would have any drug interactions for that, but certainly something to consider, since once trigeminal neuralgia flares, it tends to take quite a while to die down. What's going on? Well, in your case, quite likely the virus disrupts the transmission of impulses on an already compromised nerve and causes, well, basically noise, like static on a phone line. And that static is interpreted as pain by your brain. Not a very good situation, and one I know you would love to avoid in the future. So my advice is talk to your neurologist or perhaps your primary care doctor about the association and see if they would be willing to prescribe a low-dose prophylactic agent. Another email here, this one from Dawn in Vancouver, Washington, regarding gluten intolerance. Dear Dr. Dawn, could you comment on Intero Labs? I have a family member who recommended it to me and says they can test whether or not one is gluten intolerant by stool samples that patients send to them. There's some controversy on internet discussions. The lab was recommended by a naturopathic doctor. I've tried a gluten-free diet for a week and did not find it was making any difference. I have generally good health, but I do have mild psoriasis. I'm a little skeptical. First of all, gluten intolerance is an area of great controversy in general in medicine. And I think the simplest way for me to frame it for you is to say that there's a spectrum of manifestations, and certainly psoriasis, even mild psoriasis, could be a manifestation. Who's tried a gluten-free diet for a week and not much happened? Well, that's like trying Christianity for a week and not being saved. It doesn't really prove anything one way or another. Gluten is a fairly insidious thing, because if you are reacting to it, can manifest in a lot of different ways. And it can manifest as attacks on the liver, like hepatitis. It can manifest as a foggy brain. It can manifest as joint pain, various dermatitises and rashes, or gastrointestinal effects. And however it's manifesting, once that ball is rolling, it takes months of gluten-free living, at least 3 to 4 weeks, before you're going to see a damping down of symptoms. Even then, it isn't a dramatic effect. What's dramatic is after you've been gluten-free for a couple of months and then you eat some gluten, if you're sensitive at that point, that's dramatic. And we sometimes call that the elimination and challenge test. And it's still, albeit inconvenient, the best way to identify whether a person is gluten reactive. But most of us aren't willing to do it. So the next best compromise, in my medical opinion, is blood tests, testing for the presence of antibodies to tissue transglutaminase. So how can you get this test? You really want to get anti-tissue transglutaminase in both the immunoglobulin A and the immunoglobulin G form. So those can be ordered. If you do that, you also have to get a total immunoglobulin A, since 10% of the population doesn't make immunoglobulin A, so they'll have a false negative on this test. But this is considered to be about roughly 90% sensitive in detecting people who either are actively in trouble with gluten or have been in the past. That's about as good as it gets. This test is available widely at labs. I have found it inexpensively through a company in Florida called the Life Extension Foundation, and you can find them online very easily. And they will let you buy the test. Florida laws let you do this without a doctor's order. So you can just buy the test from them and have it drawn at a local lab and then mail it back to them. And that's what I recommend you do if your doctor is unwilling to order this test for you in California. That's out of your pocket, not covered by your insurance. But in any event, those are the tests. You can also get anti-gliotin, which I think is a decent test, but the TTG and the for IgA and IgG are considered better than anti-gliotin, less likely to have a false negative. Hope that's helpful to you. Let me talk about this broken policy process. This is a wonderful essay brought by Jeffrey Sachs. Mr. Sachs wrote this for this current February 2010 issue of Scientific American. And I'm wanting to just shoot you off to the website, scientificamerican.com, February 2010, to take a look at this. The recent thing that came through the Supreme Court this week and's got everybody in a little bit of a tizzy regarding corporate contributions or the ability of corporations to buy ads in support of candidates or also in support of policy creates a really, really interesting challenge for all of us. The policy challenge, as Jeffrey Sachs puts it, is when we let the private sector enter into public decision-making, we end up with relentless lobbying, money-driven politics, suppression of new technologies by incumbent interests, and sometimes miserable choices devoid of serious scientific content. How can business and government work together without falling prey to special interests? And that is a really good question. How can we do that? And this latest Supreme Court decision makes it more difficult. Jeffrey Sachs is talking in terms of global warming, which is a much bigger picture, really, in the long run than healthcare. But I think what we've watched as far as the process with the healthcare, let me put that in quote marks, reform, definitely qualifies as an additional example of what we need to fix. Now, getting rid of the filibuster is a good idea, but really that isn't going to fix the real problem in our democracy, which is a disconnect between the desires of the people and the factors which lead to re-election. Jeffrey Sachs actually offers a solution in the great tradition of American Indian work, where the idea is you don't criticize unless you have a suggestion. Jeffrey Sachs makes a suggestion, which, although it's a little bit of a utopia, another internet utopia, I'd like to point out why I think this is a really good idea. You can sterilize with light. Ultraviolet radiation kills germs. And I think if you throw enough light onto the political process, you can sterilize it as well. Jeffrey says, first, the administration should initiate a more open, transparent, and systemic public-private policy process. So what you would do is have a high-level roundtable with the National Academy of Sciences and whatever other private business, non-governmental organizations and scientists and engineers. Basically, the experts get together and they have a roundtable. It's web-based. It's available for submissions and testimonies. People can make input. After 6 to 12 months, a report comes out with technical overviews and policy opinions, also available online to the people and open for commentary. Then the administration would draft legislation and the experts in the roundtables would comment, and it would be open for comment by the people and web-based submission. Then the congressional consideration of these issues would also be available for comment. And wouldn't all of that be wonderful? Wouldn't it be fantastic if we could make that happen? And isn't it, through the miracle of our current technology, absolutely possible? Tom Schaefer in Cupertino writes, I'm wondering about CoQ10 dosage. Where does your recommended dosage of 200 milligrams a day of CoQ10 for statin users come from? Is it based on some published research? It occurs to me that a more scientific approach would be for me to get a CoQ10 blood test when I'm not taking statins, then adjust the dosage when I am on statins to achieve the same serum concentration of CoQ10, which might take several more blood tests. Does that seem reasonable, and any idea how much the test would cost? Well, Tom, yes, that's very reasonable and very scientific, and it will cost several hundred dollars at a minimum, which is why we don't do it. But it has been done in a scientific setting to try and figure out how much you need to give of the CoQ10 to treat against the effect that occurs with the statin. And the answer is 150 to 200 milligrams. But I think if you want to be semi-scientific, I would take the statin and the 200 milligrams of CoQ10. And by the way, different brands vary greatly in their bioavailability. So it's important to use the kind of CoQ10 that comes in a yellow, oily base. That one is much better absorbed than the one that is in a like a pale beige powder. And having taken the CoQ10, what you're really looking at is, do I have a middle of the road blood level? You're really shooting for sort of the middle of the reference range of healthy people. And if you've got that, then I shouldn't say healthy people, I should say apparently healthy people, since there is an old saying in medicine that the definition of a healthy man is someone who hasn't been sufficiently evaluated. There is little danger of that in medicine. If we're not careful, we tend to go to town too much on what might be wrong with you, as opposed to what actually is at the moment wrong with you. Anyway, that's a digression. I hope you find that answer helpful. Another one, this is from an anonymous emailer in Ontario, Canada. We have a sleepless household due to our six-week-old baby. She's growing and requires lots of nighttime feedings. I've been chronically sleep-deprived for the last month and I'm starting to feel the effects of such poor sleep. Muscle achiness, headaches, sometimes nausea, and poor articulation, not being able to find the right words, for example. I know you mentioned you went through a sleepless period as a resident and your experience. How long will it take to recover from this? I feel like I could sleep for a year. And as always, thanks for such a great show. Well, anonymous in Ontario. First of all, with the six-week-old baby, I strongly recommend a combination of tag teams and earplugs, trying to let alternating parents get up and do the nighttime feedings, freezing some breast milk, and then having it available so that the mammary-challenged partner can do his share of feedings is really important. And then if you can sleep for at least 90 minutes with earplugs and let the other partner get up for one cycle and trade back and forth, that actually will help a lot in getting through the night. If you can even just dip down into deep sleep, it's extremely helpful. The other thing is naps. Having frequent naps during the day, even if it means working with your employer, changing your work schedule, maybe taking 2 hours off in the middle of the day and working an hour later so that you can get a power nap in the middle of the day, extremely important to see if you can get that to happen. So with respect to how long does it take to recover, I'm thinking that 2 good solid nights of sleep will pretty much get you back to where you feel normal. Thank goodness the brain does recover very, very rapidly from that. Here's another email from Jan in Santa Cruz regarding reverse osmosis water filter and minerals. I have a reverse osmosis water filter. Do I need to take trace mineral supplements? I have osteoporosis. What's the best calcium to take and in what amount? I hear that microcrystalline hydroxyapatite is good. And what are the recommended supplements for a healthy 66-year-old woman? Presently, I'm taking a daily vitamin, ALA, lecithin, omegas, calcium, MSN, Celadrin, vitamins, B-complex, D3E, Rejuvizyme, and should I add or eliminate any? Well, Jan, probably you should eliminate some of those. That's an awful lot of supplements, and I suspect redundant or, you know, very minimal incremental benefits on some of those. But without seeing the specifics of your products, I wouldn't give you any definite prescriptive advice over the telephone. With respect to the reverse osmosis water filter, you do need to take trace mineral supplements because it does remove the minerals from the water, but you are getting those trace minerals in your daily multivitamin. So I think you're covered there. I like calcium that is in an easily disassociatable form. Calcium citrate, if you can tolerate it, is very good. It dissociates easily. I'm also very fond of chewable calciums or calciums that are available in a powdered form that can be mixed with water. I think those are extremely useful and helpful and go a long, long way to getting absorbed. Something else with osteoporosis that I like to recommend is that you get the deoxypyrrolidium and pyridinium end products, and these are urine tests which tell you whether you are in net bone breakdown or neutral net. So in other words, if you're losing bone faster than you're building it, these compounds will be high in your urine. And if you are in good bone balance, they'll be low in your urine. This is a test that is readily available. Your doctor can order it. It's an established test. It's not something that's not going to be covered by insurance, particularly if you have an osteoporosis diagnosis. So I want to strongly recommend that we try that. And let's try now. I'm going to go to... Hi, Aradia.
Oh, I'm so happy.
Yes, thank you for hanging in there.
Oh, no, no. I love your show. I listen to it religiously, if there's such a thing as religiously. But I have a dual problem. I have hypothyroid, and I'm taking Synthroid 0.05 mg, and that throws my TSH down to 0.832. Problem is, still dead. Everything hurts, barely can get up. But I also have a second thing going that I got upper respiratory syndrome, whatever, and I tried to use the mask, wasn't able to do it. So I don't know if these two things are combining.
Yeah, probably. You have obstructive sleep apnea?
Yeah.
Okay. Obstructive sleep apnea is OSA. They love to give things initials, and I don't think it helps one bit, but there is a subset of the population that goes deer in the headlights when you throw more than three syllables at them, and I know because they're in my practice, so maybe initials make it easier for them. Anyway, to come back to your question, the obstructive sleep apnea means that you don't actually get good quality sleep, like that earlier letter or email, I should say, from the fellow who isn't sleeping well because of the six-week-old baby.
Right. I was listening attentively.
Yeah. If you aren't sleeping well because you're suffocating, and that's effectively what OSA is, you fall asleep, you get nice and deeply asleep. At that point, the structures in the throat relax so much that they cut off your ability to breathe. You start to suffocate, and you wake up. You don't wake up all the way, but you wake up out of deep sleep. And so you spend the entire night dipping like a stone being tossed across the surface of a lake, but never really submerging into deep restorative sleep. So that's the problem that happens. And then what you see the next day is a person who is sleep deprived, and so they're tired. So you have a bad combination there, since it's hard to tell where your symptoms are coming from.
Right.
With the thyroid, have your doctor check a T3 and a reverse T3. These are both available.
Is T3 uptake, is that the same thing as reverse?
No.
T3 she's uptake. Only doing the T.
Yeah, I know. She's a standard conventionally trained doctor.
I love her.
Standard conventional medicine training says T3 uptake is the test to do. That is about 20 years old.
Okay.
That information, but that's what I was taught in medical school as well. The trouble with T3 uptake is it's an indirect measurement, and it doesn't tell you the difference between active T3 and inactive T3. You see, the problem is if a person's body isn't converting the T4 into active T3, then you feel like you don't have enough thyroid, even though the blood levels are fine.
Yes.
And people can not convert for a great variety of reasons. Iodine, lack of iodine is one. Micronutrient deficiencies like low selenium is another. People can have some other illness, diabetes, kidney failure, chronic whatever, and that will interfere with their cellular health, and then they won't convert their T3 well, and then they'll have two problems. So looking at the T3 to reverse T3, and what I've been doing is if I find a patient who has a normal TSH, or an a good TSH who's on T4 and they're not feeling better, I look at this ratio, and if it's not at least 5-1 on the active T3 to the reverse T3, then I try giving them just a little bit of T3, just a touch, maybe 10% of the dose that you're currently getting, to see if that perks them up. And if the problem is T3 deficiency, relative T3 deficiency, then that perks them up. And you have to be careful not to overdose it. This is definitely specialty level stuff. You don't do this on your own. You don't buy the drugs from Canada or whatever.
Right. No, I'm not interested in that.
You know, you really want to be careful about it, but it can make a big difference. And there's plenty of literature out there to support it, but it's still considered somewhat alternative, somewhat cutting edge, and that's fine. There's a good background of its safety, and in the proper hands, I think it's a good thing to do. And it doesn't always work, and one has to monitor the patient, and you can make osteoporosis worse if you give someone too much thyroid. So it's important to check those urine markers for bone reabsorption that I mentioned in an earlier segment of the program.
I did go see Richard Chames, however you say his last name, and he wanted me to be on T3, but my doctor was completely alarmed. It was very little bit. It did seem to perk me up, but she felt it was horribly dangerous and took me off, and then I went back into a slump.
Well, see, you've already done the test. You didn't tell me that, naughty girl.
No, she didn't. Actually, Shames didn't do the test. He just saw that I've been ill for 20 years, and obviously I wasn't converting. He looked at all my medical stuff. It took like a whole hour, and he says, you need T3, T4, adrenal support. But then when I took it down to my primary doctor, she took me off the T3 because she said, that's not done. It's too dangerous. Yeah. And so here I am laying in bed.
Okay. So you're going to have to decide which doctor to believe.
Okay.
Anyway, good luck to you.
Thank you so much for your time. I love your show.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's take another call. Kate in Santa Cruz. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm calling because I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease.
Yes.
I'm not taking medication. I'm not working with any doctors. And I'm trying to do it holistically.
First of all, what are you doing holistically for your Crohn's disease?
Changing my diet.
Be specific.
I've eliminated gluten, soy, dairy, and pretty much all animal products. More of a vegan diet. And every now and then I have some fish. I'm taking probiotics and enzymes and vitamin D, fish oil.
Good.
And I've also enrolled in a stress reduction class.
Good. You've taken a lot of very positive steps. I particularly like the vitamin D and the probiotics. I think those are both really fundamental treatments for Crohn's disease. How severe, do you have anemia? Let's start with just how bad off are you at the moment? Do you have anemia?
I'm not sure. I'm going to get a blood test, I think, just to check those things.
Do you see blood when you poop?
No. I was diagnosed with mild, so not that bad.
Okay.
The main thing is I know my stomach's inflamed because when I touch it around my belly button, for instance, it just really hurts just a touch.
All right. So one of the problems with Crohn's disease is that it causes inflammation in the small intestine. And Crohn's disease is an autoimmune disease, and it can be triggered by a number of things. It can be triggered by bacterial infections and amplified by stress. It probably can be triggered by viral infections in some of us. And once it gets rolling, it's a true autoimmune disease. So your immune system is attacking the colon and the small intestine. If you feel pain and irritability just with lightly pushing on your tummy, you probably have some activity. A quick and inexpensive way of checking whether you're in remission or not is to actually look for trace amounts of blood in your stool, and you can do that with an over-the-counter test you can buy at any drugstore.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so if you're trying to, either because of the expense of medical care or because of just a kind of distrust of conventional medical treatment, you want to use holistic methods, that's certainly within your prerogatives. But if you do that, you also have to monitor yourself and be sure that you're on the right track, right? Makes sense?
Yeah.
So I would be most reassured to know that while you have this pain, you're not in such a state of inflammation that you're actively bleeding. Another thing I want to point out to you is that it's very easy for you to develop a multi-nutrient deficiency because a lot of things that are absorbed in the small intestine, a lot of vitamins, may not be well absorbed because you have this problem. So depending on what your financial situation is like, getting one of these tests where they look at your nutritional status across the board might be not a bad idea. One company that does that is a company called SpectraCell, and they actually measure whether you have enough of the basic nutrients in your cells for normal physiology. And those are things that you have to keep an eye on because they're things that can potentially go wrong for you. And if you're doing this outside of conventional medicine, even conventional medicine for that matter, doesn't really think through the effects of micronutrient deficiencies. It's outside of the awareness of most physicians, unfortunately. And it shouldn't be, but it is. When to worry about Crohn's disease is when you have copious bloody diarrhea, when you have lots of stools and you see blood and mucus that's very active and inflamed. And sometimes we actually have to resort, even those of us who have a naturopathic bent, have to resort to the use of things like cortisone enemas or oral steroids short term, because you can actually die from this when it gets really severe.
Okay,
so I'm glad it's mild, and I think you're totally on track with your diet. Another thing that would be useful for you is to get food allergy testing. And you may have, because of the Crohn's disease, developed a lot of food sensitivities. And so if you get tested for IgG, immunoglobulin G, and you find that you are perhaps very positive for peanuts and salmon and, you know, maybe some foods that you are eating, you'll want to eliminate those as well, because anything that you have a lot of antibody to will tend to trigger and amplify the immune response, and that's what you're trying to do. You mentioned you're using probiotics. How many billions of organisms are you taking? Do you have any idea?
I believe one of them is 15 billion per one capsule.
Okay, that's not bad. That's, you know, in the ballpark of what I would like to see. For maintenance, you might need more initially. There are also some compounds. Boswellia is a very good anti-inflammatory, curcuminoids. And if you go to my website, askdrdawn.com, and you look at in the archives for the June 13th, 2009 interview with Gerard Mullen, he's an expert in inflammatory bowel disease. And there's a whole hour talking with an expert about natural therapies. And this fellow has major conventional medicine credentials, but he's gone beyond conventional medicine. He does conventional and alternative together, which is what we should all be doing, because that's what works best. It's the best of both worlds.
Okay,
so go do a little homework, and good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. It sounds like Kate is really on the right track with how she's approaching this, and I encourage everyone to think in terms of blended medicine. There's a lot of good science supporting these alternative things, but just because your primary care doctor, who is very busy and can barely keep up with the requirements of doing primary care, just because that person hasn't heard of it, doesn't mean it's not legitimate. It just means they haven't had a chance to encounter the information. Let's go to Lynn in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lynn. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm good.
I'm calling about my 23-year-old son.
Okay.
Who, for the second time in a year, has had a case of strep throat and ended up having to go to a doctor to get one of his tonsils drained.
Same side? He's only had one tonsil drained, right?
I'm not sure about whether it was both of them or whether it was just one.
Okay, so he actually developed pus behind the tonsil. That's
yes.
Extremely unusual nowadays because we throw the antibiotics around so liberally.
Uh-huh.
But in the 1950s, standard part of primary care training was learning how to drain a peritonsillar abscess.
Yeah, this is the second time it happened approximately a year ago, and it just happened again.
And do you think he had the abscess on the same side?
I think it was on the same side.
I would bet it was.
The other thing is that the doctor that he just went to said that there was some sort of irregularity in terms of the shape of, I believe it was the right tonsil, and mm-hmm. that he should have someone look at it.
I'm thinking that there may be a structural problem, could be an inborn, you know, basically a typo in development, so that he has tonsil, which for some reason is more vulnerable to forming an abscess. Maybe there's a pocket there that can get filled with bacteria. Mm-hmm. And
Just throw this into the mix.
Yeah.
As a child, grade school, high school, and so forth, and he just got done graduating from college, for the most part, this kid just really never gets sick.
Mm-hmm.
Until this last year, and then he's had these, couple of bouts with strep throat. So.
Yeah. Okay, so just because it's so unusual nowadays to form these abscesses, and he's had two, I'm thinking you really need to seriously consider a tonsillectomy, ear, nose, and throat consultation at a minimum. It's very rare for people to develop a tumor in the tonsil.
Uh-huh.
It's very, 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 very rare, and I don't want you freaking out.
Yeah.
But it's on the list of possible things. When you start getting odd infections in one location,
uh-huh.
you got to say, okay, what's wrong with this location that it's vulnerable?
Okay, that sort of brings up the other question that comes to my mind is
sure.
that my son, who is now 23, has fallen off my insurance. So, and currently, with the way the economy is, he has, at this point, doesn't have a job, and has no insurance.
Did he file a tax return last year?
Yes, he did.
Okay. So what was his income? Was it, low?
It was very low.
Good. If he has a disease,
uh-huh.
what county is he in?
He's down in San Diego right now.
Okay, so I can speak for this county. I can speak for San Bernardino County, where I trained, where I presume they haven't changed the laws. I don't know about San Diego specifically, because this is a county-wide thing. But if you are in the poverty level, and you can prove it with a tax return,
mm-hmm.
and you have a life-threatening medical condition,
mm-hmm.
you get taken care of.
Mm.
So he would qualify for short-term Medi-Cal for this problem. He wouldn't qualify for ongoing Medi-Cal, but he would qualify for it for the management of this disease.
Okay.
So getting into an ear, nose, and throat doctor, that's step one, and that you'll pay for.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a couple $100 for the office visit. It's not horrendous. And you might just have to guarantee that for him, get him in there. And once he's in there, if the doctor believes that he actually does need to have the tonsil removed,
mm-hmm.
then that doctor will work with the county. He'll write a letter, basically. Your son will take that to the local Medi-Cal office, and a whole bunch of paperwork will be pushed around. But more than likely, he'll get authorized to have the tonsils out.
Mm. My original thought in terms of, going at this problem was, to shop around for a doctor. And the question I had was, how does one shop around for a doctor for, a situation like this, since you really don't know what the, at least I wouldn't have an idea about what the initial condition would actually lead to in terms of a treatment. So,
well, this is why you called.
And yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, and so the answer is basically you need an ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You need to go in to keep the visit cheap. You want to go in with the documentation of the two previous visits where he had the tonsil drained.
Mm-hmm.
So he needs copies of those reports and walks in with them.
Okay.
And if there are any cultures where they've documented what bacteria it was, particularly if it's culture-proven strep, the standard indication for tonsillectomy would be two documented episodes of strep that were incapacitating within a one-year period.
Mm.
So in other words, if you have to have the tonsil drained, that would count.
Okay.
And if you can prove it was strep both times, then you're basically, you meet the criteria on paper, which means the bureaucrat has to give you what the law says they have to give you.
Mm.
But you document.
Okay, well, see if we can do that.
Do your best. Paper's a wonderful thing. Okay, good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Got a little time for some interesting tidbits in the news. This was published recently in the British Journal of Nutrition. I thought this was fascinating. This is a group in Serbia did this research using a traditional herbal remedy there, which is the olive tree. So olive leaf extract has been touted as a potential remedy for type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. These researchers looked at its biological activity in autoimmune type 1 diabetes, and it was a very interesting bit of research. It was lab rat research, so let's be clear, and they used two different models of human type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease, These are rats where they're given a chemical that triggers loss of the pancreas and inflammation and autoimmune attack on the pancreas, and then eventual development of type 1 insulin deficiency diabetes. They were using a dried olive leaf extract in these animals, and they were able to reverse the type 1 diabetes. They induced the diabetes, and then when they gave the olive leaf extract in the group that received that, they blocked the destruction of the beta cells. They blocked the pro-inflammatory cytokines, interferon gamma, IL-17, and tumor necrosis factor alpha, and so saw a failure of the induction of diabetes, whereas in the control group, they did induce diabetes. So the thought that maybe this olive leaf extract could be used in the early stages of type 1 diabetes, or even given in people with a high family history or a risk factor, very interesting idea. This I got from the internet, written by an author, Kathy Kwan. It's a discussion of zinc toxicity from denture cream. Now, denture creams are used by lots of people to keep their dentures in place. And in general, one tube of denture cream is supposed to last from 3 to 10 weeks. But people have used, when their dentures don't fit well, they just glom on lots and lots of cream. And there have been some reports of neuropathy, that is to say, nerve damage. And these are attributable to high dose denture cream. Now, lots of denture adhesives list zinc on the label, but apparently some of the ones that don't list zinc also have it. I'm recommending that if you use more than a small amount of denture cream, that you ask your doctor to check a red blood cell zinc level to make sure that you are not zinc toxic from your denture cream. This is relatively recent information. The study showing the association was published in the August 2008 issue of Neurology. So just a little heads up there, and thanks to the caller who brought that to my attention last week. Let's talk now to Jerry in Santa Cruz.
Morning.
Good morning.
We talk a lot about how there are medicines available from Canadian pharmacies, you know, at a cheaper rate. But my understanding is that most of them are either in the U.S. or they're fraudulent to begin with. And the question is, how do we find, in fact, a reputable Canadian pharmacy?
Go to Canada. And make friends with somebody in Canada. I'm not kidding.
Really?
Or make friends with somebody who lives along the border. I bet you there's somebody running a bootleg drug business, more than one somebody's actually. I guess I'm not recommending you do this, but I'm just saying I bet you it's out there. The problem with going online is that anybody can be anything online.
Right.
You know, you can have your little Facebook with the cute little buxom teenager, and actually it's a 45-year-old male lurker who's got that Facebook page. I mean, anybody can be anything online, and that includes very fly-by-night outfits out of Taiwan or Malaysia selling counterfeit or out-of-date or drugs that have been dumped on their markets back to America. And I've seen that. I had a patient who wanted to get the weight loss drug Rebombavant, which was never approved in the United States. It was a marijuana-derived or a THC blocker, so a sort of munchy blocking drug. And they never did approve it here, but you could get it in Europe. And so they bought it from, quote-unquote, Canada. But then when it came, they brought it in, and I looked at it, and it actually came from Malaysia. So
to ask the question in a different way, let's say that I knew someone in Toronto, and I needed a medication for which is a prescription. I can't simply send my prescription to my friend in Toronto and have them fill it out their local pharmacy, can I?
Well, if you think hard about how you might pull that off, there's some obvious strategies. You can probably do that. I don't really know exactly how careful the Canadian pharmacies are not to let someone bring in a prescription. You could visit, you know. I don't know how much the drug costs. It might not be worth the price of the plane ticket.
Right.
What you should really do, honestly, Jerry, is you should get in the face of your senator, who, if you're in this state, is a Democrat, and just tear the air at them. Just, hello, why did you let that get taken out of health reform? Why did we not say that the United States is going to bargain shop? We're going to use our collective bargaining power to get prices down for drugs. You know, why not? The Canadians do it. We have three times the bargaining power of Canada. What we don't have is a democracy at the moment.
Right.
So we need to fix that and definitely make it very clear to the people that are in office that it really doesn't matter how good their ads are. We're not voting for them if they don't support this.
I agree with you. I think we're losing America to the corporation. I mean, there was this Supreme Court thing the other day about how, you know, corporations can now fund politicians. We're losing that battle, I'm afraid.
Well, like the article I recommended that was in the Scientific American this month by Jeffrey Sachs, really do recommend everybody take a look at that, because there is always a way. The question is it feasible? Is it possible? And like I said, ultraviolet light kills germs. And I think scrutiny and transparency, we just need to demand that. Yeah. And there's no way they can really stop us from having a website where the minute that somebody gets up on CNN to talk, there's a little overlay on the broadcast that lists, you know, the corporations that are associated with this individual and that have donated to him. You know, with that kind of information, it's like, well, consider the source. There's no way that you can be sure online or at a distance that you're buying from a Canadian pharmacy. There just isn't. And there's plenty of people with an interest in cheating you.
Sure. Thank you much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We got an off-air call from a regular listener, Jim in Big Sur, who says he got a Canadian phone book in the library, called up a pharmacy listed there, assuming that a reputable pharmacy would be in the phone book, and they were able to get him a drug that wasn't made in the U.S. anymore. So I have a feeling that there's plenty of pharmacists up there that are sympathetic to our plight down here in the hinterland. So maybe that's a strategy to consider. Let's talk to Jill in Monterey. Hello, Jill. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. It's such a wonderful show you do. There were two things. One is the life extension folks had suggested, I'd read some years ago, taking BHT in a consistent manner for about 6 months will tend to knock out herpes virus. And I actually had some success with that.
I don't know if
you know anything about that, but that was in one of their initial books. The other thing was, I was curious what your thinking was about the John Sarno's work with pain, working with the psychosomatic aspect of things.
I haven't read his book. My producer here has supplied the name of the book. The author is Dr. John Sarno. The book is Healing Back Pain, the Mind-Body Prescription.
Yeah.
I have not read this book.
Okay.
In terms of pain and psychosomatic aspects of pain, there is no wall between the mind and the body. The interconnections between the brain and the immune system and the brain and the nerves. And after all pain is perceived in the brain up until the point it gets to the thalamus. It's just information. It's just literally like Morse code. Dit, dot, 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 dit. And when you have an increased signal, it's just dit. And whether your brain translates that into pain or a tickling is up to your brain. And definitely subject to memories, buried subconscious stuff, what's going on in your everyday life, the level of neurological alertness that's generated, multiple feedback loops around your diet, around your behavior, around your neurological and genetic tendencies towards addiction. So it's incredibly complicated.
We know
that hypnosis is effective. We know that acupuncture is effective. We know that some herbs are effective. It's just that some are effective in some people, and all of these things tend to be operator dependent.
Right.
One acupuncturist or one hypnotist may get much better results with a particular patient than another. It's not as interchangeable as, you know, take two aspirin and call me in the morning.
Oh, not machine.
Right.
Fortunately.
But I do believe that it is an extremely important aspect and needs to be addressed whenever a person is suffering from persistent chronic pain. Because the pain itself will generate a psychosomatic component, guarding, avoidance of certain movements, apprehension, and heightened awareness of the pain. These are all things that are demonstrably happen in your brain that can be addressed separate from whatever the distant pain driver that's stimulating the nerve in the first place.
Great.
Well, thank you very much for mentioning the book, and have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks again.
Bye-bye. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.